Joe, how are you doing?
Just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very good. Very good. So this week, I wanted to talk about, it was a video that someone sent to me, got my attention by this YouTuber, goes by the name Really Graceful. And she put, it's a video about Miley Cyrus. What the heck is happening to Miley Cyrus? And, you know, the path her career has taken. How she developed, you know, through the Disney Corporation, the Disney Channel, became a pop star. Now she became she's become the whore of Babylon, like so many other Disney pop stars, people who emerge from their stables. I imagine you saw the video.
I did. It was disgusting in the extreme.
And yeah, she basically raises the question: what's exactly going on there? And you have these stars that you know. That are supposedly developed to cater to children and it's children's entertainment, and it's almost like a formula. They gain popularity, or they're promoted. This sort of celebrity that we're dealing with is in my opinion, is completely manufactured. It's not based on any real talent or luck or what people usually think. What happens? How people become celebrities. It's like they're manufactured, and Disney, spews these kids out like through the sausage grinder. And I think it's an apt analogy because they really are ground meat. And that the strategy here is you create a star. It's almost overnight. They're a celebrity. They're famous because they're everywhere. They're famous because they're famous, and they're put on television, cable television. They get movies. However, music is distributed, promoted these days, and gets. The parents let their kids watch this stuff, and all of a sudden they're popular. And you walk in the toy department over there at Walmart, and Hannah Montana stuff is all over the place. This was the case about a decade ago, and she's a phenomenon. She's a phenomenon for being a phenomenon, I guess, and that's how they like it. These celebrities. So, what's your take on celebrity culture? And if you want to focus on a couple of cases, whether it's Britney Spears, Amanda Bynes, or Miley Cyrus, they all seem to go crazy after a while. They sort of this programming process. They lose it. So what do you think's going on here?
Well, I think Miley is probably the clearest example. I'm almost glad Miley Cyrus exists because she is basically like one of those anatomical dolls that have everything cut away so you can see the organs inside of it. I mean, her op was really obvious and deliberate. I mean, she was created as Hannah Montana, kind of a rhyming name, easy to get into the mind of children, with two personalities. Mm-hmm. And one of them was a rock star. So one of them was like a normal little girl who was basically had this really magical life, was very identifiable. So all of these very young girls, I would say, Miley was, as Hannah Montana, was pulling in an audience of young girls as early as people would let kids watch TV. I mean, I would think probably 4 years old would be, the baseline. And this went on for years, and they, obviously manipulated her into a very visible cultural moment, where she was. You'd go into Walmart and you'd see Hannah Montana clothing, for God's sake. She was everywhere. But she always had this other side to her, which was the hidden half of her personality, which was that she was actually a rock and roll singer. So the young children that were identifying her were fully identifying with a normal person like themselves. This was Hannah Montana. But they're also learning subconsciously, neuro-linguistic programming, that this individual was going to be a pop star. I mean, all the shows had this aspect to them that, you know, had a regular life, and then she would sway and become this, like, you know, music star. And so now, I mean, this went on for, I would guess, like 6 or 7 years, maybe less, maybe 5 years, that Hannah Montana's career, you know, sort of went forward, and she became very famous. And then she became the adult Miley Cyrus, and there was a very brief transition. I don't think the period between Miley Cyrus and the Whore of Babylon was, you know, 6 months, where she suddenly became an adult star and she was graphically sexual, right? And I mean just flat out graphically sexual. And then came her performance at the MTV Awards show, which was really, I think this was pretty much what she had been created to do. She took on kind of the characteristics of an animal. I would say probably a female dog in heat would be actually what she was trying to emulate. And I'm not exaggerating. It isn't a metaphor, Tim. I mean, that's what I think she, you know, she was being, you know, copulated. There was a guy in basically a prison outfit, black and white stripes, who would be copulating her. I mean, they had their clothes on, but they were simulating copulation. And so, she was,
this is Robin Thicke, right?
Hands and knees. And during the entire performance, she had developed the ability to have her tongue out. So the tongue was just way out of her mouth. And the camera would actually swing by and pick up this feature. So, you know, you have this idea of an animal having sex, right? It's almost as if it's, you know, a fantasy where Hannah has created this identification, which now is being exploited to basically disassociate the people that have grown up with her. And I mean, some of the people that are watching the video now would be early teens, but they have been exposed to the first iteration of Hannah Montana, and now they've transitioned through the neuro-linguistic programming into her, you know, life as a rock star. And then they will now basically take on the attributes. In other words, this is, I mean, clear cut as to what we're looking at, is they are they're trying to set up the children so that they will take on the attributes. This is a long-standing program. I'm certain that the Disney Masonic complex, you know, in the 50s worked on this. You know, they had the Mouseketeers, you know, and which had these kind of pubescent, you know, girls with mouse outfits on. And this, of course, was before the bunny. But you basically have the idea of sexualized humans that are animals. And there was particularly one that was, you know, precocious, and her name was Annette Funicello, who became the star, the kind of breakout star. And she was the breakout star because she had such big breasts at like 11. And so she became the star with her mouse hat on. But, you know, when you look at, you know, what exactly is going on here, well, I don't think it's that complicated. I think that if you look at the influence of, you know, the Frankfurt School, and which was hired then by the American Jewish Committee, which then brought out the authoritarian personality, which is just flat out says we're going to basically transition European culture using Eros. And they talked about it being propaganda. Now, the Frankfurt School's, you know, set piece moment, in other words, they're, you know, where the arsenal is rolled out so people can just see it really clearly, is Herbert Marcuse's Eros and Civilization, which in the at the time of the, you know, the youth movement, so-called the counterculture in the late 60s, was just everywhere. And it talks about basically kind of polysexualism, right, where the gender is broken down. It was anticipating kind of the transgender popularity that the media is promoting today. But all you have to do is just look back one iteration, and you can see where all this comes from. Or you can see at least at a moment where it's, I think, a little easier for people to understand what the process will be, so we can understand what we've been going through. Because if you look at the Hungarian Revolution, and this the same phenomena went on in the Bolshevik, but it's a lot harder to get details about that because they did a better job of scrubbing the literature. But in the Hungarian Revolution, the Hungarian Soviet in 1919, Bela Kun, not his real name, which was Kohn, real name Kohn, he gave the direction of the nation's culture, the I forget the title it was, but it was Commissar of, you know, culture, basically. And he gave it to Gregor Lukacs, who was the founder of the Frankfurt School. So that when the Frankfurt School goes forward, they're really just basically, using Lukacs's understanding of culture and what he wanted to do to culture as their platform. Just clear as a bell, the Frankfurt School is not a reflection of Lukacs. It is Lukacs himself. He was there. He organized it. These are his ideas. And so then when you see what Lukacs did during the 1919 Hungarian proletariat, you can see Miley Cyrus. Because, Lukacs said, look, we need to educate the children to free love and to despise their monogamous parents. Now, he had like a cover story about Marxism as his justification, which if you go through the logic of what, you know, they were trying to hoist on the culture, you can see it's complete sophistry. You know, Marx is just a pseudo economic theory that's just basically was created to give the idea of a worker's paradise so that people would accept very intense control, you know, in a small group. And once the control was created, then suddenly you'd have just absolute destruction everywhere. People could just be slaughtered. And this is exactly what happened. But anyway, so Lukacs had what could be called a very degenerate sexual education. But he also was the commissat of public education, and he arranged for all what so-called proletariat children. Tim, this is over 120,000 kids. They would be taken to these centers and then read fairy tales. Every school and every children's hospital in Budapest participated in the program. Now, why would they do that? And Lukacs said, well, you know, we need to get at kids when they're young because they're a little more malleable. And he said that really we want them through fairy tales to encounter a world in which everything is possible for everyone in accord with their inner worth, where the characters change. I'm reading his words. Not only their class, but also their form and their life. Right. Such a world is more communist than our community, than our communists, excuse me. We abolished only the differences between human classes with the possibility provided by enchantment. The fairy tale erased the borders between animals, vegetables, and human beings. Right. So that now when you go forward through the through basically the American Jewish Committee's authoritarian personality, through cybernetics at the Macy Conference, which was basically which generated through a lot of the influence of the authoritarian personality. You've got MK Ultra, you have Walt Disney, you know, coming out of the same flow, and now suddenly Hannah Montana, where Miley Cyrus then adopts the posture of an animal, as in a fairy tale, except she's copulating. She is basically representing Lukacs's, that's not his real name, Tim, Bela Kohn. Lukacs was kind of a Hungarian name. His real name, I think, was Lowenstein. He's a Jewish guy. So when you get to Miley, you have someone who is, it's like a fairy tale. You know, she's representing herself as an animal. The border between animals and human beings is completely broken. And you also have the idea of sexual degeneracy now, and promiscuity without any restraint. So basically what you have is those young girls that have been influenced by Miley, as they go through the cultural indoctrination and they follow her, their minds have been basically preconditioned. See, this is the point I'm trying to make, is that Hannah Montana was the preconditioning so that the adult version, the Whore of Babylon Miley, would have the most powerful influence. And if they were successful with this operation, then the young women that had been influenced would basically be completely ready for pornography. You know, we were discussing before the show, Tim, about, you know, pornography and about the responsibility that women have. Mm-hmm. And the responsibility that men have. And there are different kinds of responsibilities. Both are affected in different ways. Men, I think, you know, are just preconditioned. And when they're put, pornographic images are put in front of them, there's a certain influence that just they know will occur. But women are influenced in a different way, I think, to become pornographic units in our culture.
Scarlet women.
But Miley is certainly... has been, obviously a part of it. And those that are influenced by Miley, by the basically the MTV kind of, you know, the subtle promotion of promiscuity and pornography, will have a real hard time promoting, creating a family. I follow pornography. People wonder about this, you know, and I try to... not be influenced by it, but I do try to understand it. And I have said that my opinion is it's going into a far more debased structure. Mm-hmm. And I think it's becoming more and more normalized. I think that women are being encouraged to allow themselves to be photographed in pornographic acts. And I think that the number of women that are basically agreeing to do this is skyrocketing. It's almost becoming a fad. It probably is in some ways.
Yeah, you have to have in order to become a celebrity, you have to have the prerequisite sex tape that
leads. You've got to have a sex tape, right? Yeah. And so the question I have is, well, how does someone transition from the pornography that is put on YouTube or whatever, venue it's placed on, to being a mother in a family? It seemed to me that once that's in existence, once your pornographic representation of yourself is on the internet, that it's going to be pretty difficult to have a relationship with a man that would be monogamous and would be structured around the idea of having a family. What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, that breaks that the sacredness of marriage, which is based a lot on fidelity, because that's the only assurance the man gets of paternity is the woman's fidelity, and that's so primal that the institution of marriage has been developed around that. But you do have these women in their youth. They went off, and if they had the physical attributes, they became Playboy playmates, or they did many different nude shots in movies. And then, as they get older, they want to have a family. And then we're hearing stories about how some of these starlets were victimized or treated like sex objects, like Jenny McCarthy complaining about Steven Seagal's rather crude come on. But then, if you look at the career of Jenny McCarthy. Playboy centerfold. She hosted that show Singled Out by MTV, which was all around debasing teenage and college age kids with much sexual innuendo. All these women that complain about being harassed, or some have even said rape, that's a whole other story, I don't know. But most of this, the cases I'm hearing about are women that are more or less directed towards the casting couch. And, the point is being that when they're in Hollywood, they consciously they market themselves as sex objects. And then they turn around and they're shocked that they're treated like objects. And my point is, I'm not excusing the men for their behavior, but I do think there's at least a 50% responsibility on the part of the women for their behavior, because it's these women that want to go to Hollywood and become stars. And become a star, if they think about it or not, but you more or less have to sell your soul and do these things. And, directors just take your clothes off, they take their clothes off, and it's caught in living color for all to see. And then, they're in these various scenes in movies where millions of people watch them engaging what should be an intimate act in these things, and this corrupts the audience. And many of these women take no responsibility for the culture they've helped create, because they wanted to have fame and notoriety. And I would think that if many people, I've yet to hear anyone ask some of these victims if they should apologize for the culture they've helped create. And I don't think they even recognize her. They would have a hard time even recognizing their responsibility in debasing the culture. Because, like I said, a couple months ago, there were news reports of the death of Hugh Hefner, and what a revolutionary he was, what a trailblazer he was, and what a great man he was in many respects. Because that's how mainstream media covers death. But what the behavior you're seeing in Hollywood and the behavior you're seeing in the culture in general is largely a product of Hugh Hefner's career, the mission he was given to serve. In debasing the culture. And like you said it, the Playboy Bunny, these things are sort of a dehumanization, or at least a reduction of human beings to animals. I think this is an interesting observation regarding Disney, because the anthropomorphic animal is a Disney thing. And that's a very gradual, but you look at like Annette Funicello, then you, of course, she graduates from the the Masketeer Club to these beach movies in the early 60s, right? With
Beach Blanket Bingo.
Yeah, and everyone's bopping. All these girls will bop around in bikinis, and this is all about youth and this obsession on youth and these things. At the same time that
they have all the beach movies, but let's face it, that was just a genre that was created so they could put images of girls in bikinis on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, there was one movie called The Girl with the Invisible Bikini.
Yeah.
And I remember I was wondering, they're going to show it on television. I'm thinking, I'm 11 or 12 years old, thinking, how are they going to show this on television? So I'm going to watch it, of course. And they have a cutout. And what they do is, instead of her just being there nude, the bikini, you can actually see through her. She's transparent where the bikini is. Imagine everyone's disappointment, right?
Yeah, right.
But again, that's sort of this cute. And even in those movies, there's always a again, the men are many of the men are older men are behave inappropriately, and this is why you have someone like Al Franken, who in his he's 50 years old, and there's this photograph of him acting like a frat boy towards this model. And he takes a photograph of it, not thinking about what a buffoon he looks like, But the Al Franken that we're looking at in that photograph is a product of the Playboy culture,
Well, I would disagree, just to the extent that I think Franken's in on the deal. I think he's there to culturally debase people.
Oh yeah, I mean he's more of an agent.
I don't see him as people who like that. I mean, for God's sakes, a Saturday Night Live comic,
yeah,
right, becoming a senator. I mean, that just smells.
Yeah, very, good point. Good point.
Bad to me, and I just have always assumed that guy is completely dirty. I mean, I don't have any proof.
But also the USO tour, right? Wasn't it on a USO tour?
Yeah, it was the USO tour.
Yeah, the history of the USO. If you look at USO having girls come out in bikinis and entertain the troops.
Yeah,
you mean Raquel? I mean, very sexual and
Bob Hope. Yeah. Right.
And of course, we get back to if you want to get back to Hollywood and Miley Cyrus, so sort of these. Girls are being monarch-controlled sex kittens, whatever, engineered these things through some sort of MKUltra program. Of course, we have the accusations of Bryce Taylor, right, regarding Bob Hope.
Yeah.
Whether or not that's true, I don't know. But it is if you look at – get back to Miley Cyrus. So look at her background. Her father, of course, is a country western star who is made famous overnight in the 90s. Her grandfather, Miley Cyrus's grandfather, is like a banker with the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, I mean, he was actually on the Federal Reserve Board and was a business partner, I believe, with Alan Greenspan in some endeavor. But he sat on the Federal Reserve Board with Greenspan. And so basically, you know, you all these patterns, you know, of
a banking, another banking family
Jewish,
promoting
Jewish
a pop star.
Psychologists, and then banking families. There is some structure that binds these groups together because it just keeps coming up over and over again.
Yeah, and also her mother was another supposed rags to riches story, dating back to the Nashville scene. And some people have the Nashville music scene as sort of a cover for drug trafficking. Much the same way that the rap music scene was a cover for a lot of the cocaine trafficking in the 80s and 90s for the CIA. And somebody said that Nashville, these stars, are often mules. Of course, we've heard the stories about Courtney Love and her connections to the CIA and her connections to the Presidio. She was in the Presidio in the 70s, so I understand, daycare center.
And, yeah. Do you know who her father was?
Yes.
Hank Harris, and he was Grateful Dead manager.
Yeah.
So you can see it's just this long-standing generational assault upon, you know, the culture.
And looking at the music scene, of course, the Hollywood in general, we talk about the celebrity culture. Of course, we talk about what's the function of the celebrity to begin with? Why do we have this thing called the celebrity? And that takes us back to one Edward Bernays.
Right.
And the development of Hollywood itself is a function of technology, I guess, because I think we've talked about how Hollywood itself was the efforts to expanding and making sure that every town in America had a cinema. And this was largely the work of Hayes, who oversaw the Hayes Code. And, you've talked about this, how the Hayes Code and also the Legions of Decency and the Production Code itself that was enforced for so many years. That this was a way to ease the control of Hollywood into America, so people would let their guard down. That's the same way people let their guard down with innocent Hannah Montana or innocent Britney Spears. Yeah. Then they become the whore of Babylon overnight. Same with Hollywood. Now, for the better part of 30 years, Hollywood was restrained by the production code. But
there was an ethnic component. I mean, after the Fatty Arbuckle thing, this is all like Wikipedia, just about. I mean, after the Fatty Arbuckle debacle, that was like the last straw because there had been a whole series of smaller, less known kind of debauched aspects. And I mean, we talked about in that one show, the lady that had been raped at MGM's, you know, party for the successful insertion of all of the, you know, these movie theaters. And there was a lot of ethnic response to the population saw as a Jewish media. They thought that Hollywood was kind of a Jewish cultural plot for some reason, and they actually talked about it. At that point, you know, you didn't have political correctness, and there are actually quotes about, you know, that this is a kind of a Jewish plot against European culture. This whole Hollywood, because there already was a lot of, you know, sort of unusually sexualized films that had come out. So in response to that, they got the Hays Code and they brought in the Roman Catholics, the Legion of Decency, and then that provided the political cover for Hollywood to expand itself. And this was the era where every single small town ended up with a theater in it. And now when you took the code away, suddenly the project was revealed. Mm-hmm. And they could put basically nude women into every small town in America, and they did. And I wanted to go back to the idea, you know, you've talked about this, and this is a really good point, and it's something that's not discussed often. I think it's kind of politically incorrect to do so, that women have this responsibility in the pornographic culture. Mm-hmm. They're half of the equation. And this isn't discussed enough. I don't hear people talking about this. And because in general, I think women, because they have just a biologically more unified structure into a family. I mean, they're the ones who produce the children. They should be on the alert for opportunities, you know, to try to defend the family against pornography.
Yeah, it is funny that all the parts of the female anatomy that we're drawn to has something to do with fertility.
And well, what a shock.
I mean,
that ever happened, you know, I mean, this is, but I wanted to say that, but I don't think that women, just because of, sort of how pornography is generated can really, put a dent in the momentum. The reason why pornography is, basically, you know, dominating our culture is not just the Hays Code and the internet. You know, those are the, that's how it, you know, is delivered. It's because pornographers are not beaten up. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Or arrested. Yeah.
Well, I mean, arrested. I don't think arrests will work because, frankly, I think the police are just compromised. The police aren't a gay disco at this point.
You know? Yeah, they're part of
the, but if you had, you know, a series of defense of culture whereby, you know, the people who are creating pornography, and particularly people that are the pimps of pornography, the ones that are going out and actually, you know, hiring girls or trying to seduce them. And I mean, if these people, if it just became a popular thing to do, to beat them up viciously, and that happened a few hundred times, not advocating violence here. I'm just talking theoretically. I think you'd see that pornography would be less attractive. What do you think, Tim? Is that idea sensible, or am I barking up the wrong tree?
Well, you know, consequences. You know, contemplating consequences for one's actions inhibits one's behavior, and there should be action. These people are destroying the culture, and they're creating a whole mess, and it contributes to violence and crime and these things, because it contributes to family breakup.
It's not. Yeah, I mean, wouldn't you defend? I mean, I would defend a family member, particularly a female family member, against a physical assault. I would defend a family member with my life, right? And I would use violence to defend a family member, a female, any woman. If I saw a woman being accosted on the street, believe me, it wouldn't matter if there was a bunch of guys. I would just wade in and do what I could do. And if I lost, which probably would, that would just be too bad, because that's just how things are. That's how you have to live your life. You have to actually be prepared to participate in culture. It creates you, and oftentimes it needs defense. So I would look at someone who would try to come up and you know, acquire a woman for pornography. I would just see that person exactly in the same way as if he would come up with a knife and try to stick her in the belly.
Yeah. I mean,
to me, the idea of parsing a difference between the two acts, you're going to sit there and say, oh, well, you know, let me think about the difference, the distinction before I do something. You know, you don't think, you know what's right. And so you defend her. That's just how you have to live your life if you want to live in a culture. We don't have a culture now. We have, you know, basically the Brave New World being set on top of us. And little events like letting people you know participate in pornography, you're basically just slitting your own throat, because you'll have no future if you permit these things to go on.
You know, when they started distributing pornography, widespread, wasn't just you know, relegated to, you know, the sleazier part of towns, that sort of thing. When it no longer became underground in the 1950s, of course, with the publication of Playboy magazine, the idea was this magazine was only going to be distributed to adults.
Yeah, right.
So, okay. Now, the only problem I have with that, now, let's just take for the sake of the argument, say, okay, giving to adults is not as damaging. It's not a violative act. It's not, you're not corrupting youth, and that's, you know, there's a distinction there. I grant that. Once you print this material and distribute it, how do you control its proliferation? You can't.
Oops! What a shock!
Exactly.
Can they give you a real life example?
Well, okay. I my youth. I used to. Hey, look what I found! Oh wow!
Well, okay. I grew up in London. After we moved from Japan back to the United States, we lived in Palos Verdes, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. And there was a barber shop. And, the kids, like 13, 12, 13-year-old, would always want to get their hair cut. Why? Because there was Playboy magazines there you could look at while waiting. See, there was a little room that no one was actually visibly watching you, and there, if you knew where to look, would be Playboy magazines. But Tim, every single kid who's 12 years old in Little League had access to the Playboy magazines. And now, this isn't a debauched neighborhood. It's the one I was growing up, very middle class, kind of, all being Ozzie and Harriet type stuff, But there it was. There was the Playboy magazine. Now, the barber certainly knew that they were there, and the adult men had access to them. But he, I'm sure, knew that it was good that for business that the kids were aware of it as well, because then they would not complain about going to the barber shop. And so that's how we lost our culture. Just they, you're, and that's such a good point. They knew perfectly well that once they had, millions of magazines
Out there.
out there. I mean, it's the same, it's exactly the same. Well, it's similar to the idea of getting movie theaters in every single town in America. Once you've got them there, you can use them. And they were always intended to be used to basically, the family and culture.
Well, that's the argument when you get the libertarian argument. Well, just don't buy it, just don't patronize it, whatever.
It's the stupidest argument. I mean, anyone who makes that argument seriously should basically just.
I want them to explain to me, how do you guarantee that children don't see this material? You
That
cannot
that's the
guarantee
way
it.
to do it. See, it's like, exactly. It's just the same thing of like, well, we have controls on TV. There's a parental warning. This is just how people can put up with this. Your statement is clear-minded. The onus of guarantee that the filth is not reaching the mind of the kids is on the producer, not on the consumer. We can't control that. They have to show us ironclad protections.
So
If
there
they can't.
you could have a legal case.
Of course, these people should have been sued for cultural debasement. I mean, if the ACLU and the Texas Southern, Poverty Law Center, if they were actually entities that were trying to help culture, they would have been suing these guys from the 1950s onward. There would have been no pornography industry, and there would be no show business as it is today. I mean, show business is just, as I love the expression, Michael Jones' expression, it's a gay disco. There's nothing but hookup sex and kind of a wink toward drugs and alcohol. And that's just what's given to everyone who participates in watching these things,
And what they've always done is, and this is what this is Jewish tactic is, they claim that this pornography, which is a an act of liberation, is really a subversive act, which leads to enslavement.
course. Well, I mean, just read the conclusion of the authoritarian personality. I mean, it's just, if that isn't clear enough, that this is exactly what they're trying to do.
The malevolence is there. Now, I would never, did I see any journal, I haven't seen when Hugh Hefner was being interviewed or any pornographers being interviewed, they all claimed we're all adults here. Come on, we can be free. We're all adults, blah, blah, blah. Yes, but how can you guarantee that the smut you produce doesn't get into the hands of little children? And they can never guarantee that. So what you're saying is, so you can indulge in this freedom. What you're saying is, oh, well, I don't care. I don't care if it corrupts
The
little children.
logic is completely insane. It's like, well, we put out a toxic substance, a poison, and oh my God, even though we have a label on it, somehow, like, all of the children in America were killed. Well, I'm sorry, you killed all the children. The pornography is basically damaging whole generations, you see. And so it all has to be taken into account. I mean, even shows like Ellen DeGeneres, And Walt Disney. These entities are precursors. They lead us in the wrong direction. The direction has taken us to a place where families are suffering, and there should be a way to get legal consequence. If we were a sane society, they would simply be sued out of existence. They shouldn't be able to put something as damaging and toxic as what we have today as mainstream media. They shouldn't be able to put it out there. It just shouldn't be possible.
Well, it was like what they did with the Roth decision, where they said that they didn't necessarily declare obscenity laws unconstitutional. What they said was if a porn movie had some redeeming social quality, it was no longer deemed obscene, meaning that if you have a porn film and the woman who strips nude and she's having sex with the man and they mention the Vietnam War, it has a redeeming social quality to it, and it can no longer be banned. It's ridiculous.
In other words, that was in 73, I believe, where you had the U.S. Supreme Court made the decision where they said it was going to make it easier to prosecute pornographers, but actually it made it much more difficult. That was actually, I think what's his name? Goldstein.
Screw Magazine.
Then led to all this. And so basically.
And he admitted his objective was to corrupt Christian girls, particularly Catholic girls. That was the big turn on.
That was kind of the goal. And the idea was that, so he took he was saying, look, just because it's utterly without any social value doesn't mean it's not, shouldn't be protected under free speech. I always thought that whole decision was just, wired as a kind of cover narrative just to change the laws. I think this was part of where Wechsler, working with FDR to break apart the power of the small sovereigns like cities, towns, counties, that they can't really defend themselves against federal pornography promotion. And I always thought that the Supreme Court decision was just part of that, because basically after that, the way that the logic was is that, it was saying like, well, we don't have any redeeming social value, but so what? But see, that wasn't really in my mind what was on the table. The question is does it damage?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question. And if it damages, then it isn't protected by free speech. And that's the, I just think that the 73 decision and all of the subsequent decisions in terms of pornography that were covered by free speech, it was all just part of the an organized plot against European culture. And I would just point out, Tim, notice that free speech somehow was protecting pornographers. But now, as far as like white people, using epithets against other racial groups, suddenly speech doesn't quite make it that far. So, I just think it's applied selectively and in a way that, is basically, it's just they use these things, these legal processes, just to give people the idea that there was some basis, legal basis. And even though, culture just got totally destroyed, but at least we're following the Constitution, when the fact is this is just absurd, that the real grounds that had to be determined was just simply whether or not pornography was damaging.
Yeah.
And so obviously damaging that it's just frankly insane that the legal system couldn't do anything to stop it. And I think it's not insane, Tim. I think the only real explanation is that the legal system was under control and was designed to permit something that would damage culture to come into existence.
Yeah, and if you look at some of the cases that witnesses up there talking about pornography, and some of the I was reading about how some of these court cases went down, and the lawyer in defending the pornographers would get a witness up there who was critical of pornography, and they ask you, was it purient? Did you find it? Did it stimulate you? Did you find it provocative? No one wanted to admit that they would find it provocative. And so they would say, well, if it's not provocative, what's the big deal? You know, yeah. They don't want to say it's disgusting. Well, it's disgusting, then it's not going to have that effect. Well, see the trick there? They're saying, because no one wants to admit that it's provocative, you know, that they're finding it, they might get turned on by, as they say. Everyone want to admit, act disgusted, which, of course, avoids the issue, you know, because they know people aren't going to be disgusted by it for the most part, you know.
Exactly. You know, Tim.
The dishonesty is just.
This is exactly what wasn't. They were able to frame the issue in such a way that it actually looked like they were seriously trying to apply the First Amendment or some other legal principle, when the fact is all they were really trying to do was just avoid saying that males like to watch pornography and it changes their sexual behavior. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see, that's all you need to demonstrate in order to convict these people, is that if you give a lot of pornography, particularly really graphic, you know, then this changes the behavior of males toward romance, toward courtship. Mm-hmm. Right? When you have hundreds of hours of pornography watching as a young kid from, like, say, age 12 through 14, will your behavior be any different than someone who was, you know, watched Ozzie and Harriet, was like in the Christian culture in 1950? Is that possible, Tim? Well, I would say yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think it is. And so, therefore, we have been damaged, right? And therefore, the pornographer should have been held accountable and should be held accountable. I don't think at this point the legal system is going to be much use. And so, as I was saying, you just have to protect women any way you can from this injury. And I do think that it's the responsibility of males to carry out this kind of protection. Though, you know, I mean, if a woman felt like she had to defend herself in another way, I would certainly support that. But it's just, you know, I gave the example, I've done it a couple of times, of a friend of mine who told me the story in the 50s, Lake Erie Irish community. The pornographer comes in, just dirty pictures, but he's trying to sell them. And it's selling them teenage kids because they're the most vulnerable, right? They have the highest sex drive, so they're the, you know, ones who are most taken by this thing. A dad found out about it, no problem. A group of them just got together, dragged him out of the car, and beat the hell out of him. Problem solved. So, you know, don't want to advocate violence.
And, you know, if that distributor happened to be Jewish, it would have been a case of anti-Semitism.
My God, the B'nai B'rith and the ACLU would have been, you know, like on our case. But, I mean, that's simply what has to get done. If you're worried about things like that, if you're worried about, oh, they'll say, you know, I'm anti this or anti that, then I'm sorry, you've basically lost the right to participate in your own culture.
Well, this gets us back to Hollywood, too, because Hollywood itself is largely, a Jewish operation, acknowledged as such by the Jewish power elite. I mean, that's your Neil Gabel's book, Empire of Their Own, Joel Stein and the LA
Jerusalem
Times.
Jerusalem Post talked about it.
Yeah.
They have control over all of them.
So if you criticize Hollywood and what it produces and analyze why it produces what it does, I mean, and if you go get in this Harvey Weinstein case and, you know, his obsession with deflowering or taking advantage of women, largely Gentile women, that's a phenomenon that many Jews acknowledge in the Jewish community what's that book, Portnoy's Complaint, that inspired Annie Hall, Woody Allen's Annie Hall. And that's all about, and in that book he talks about when he was sticking it to the Gentile girl. He wasn't sticking to her. He was sticking it to the family that came over on the Mayflower.
Yeah, charming. Yeah, I mean, he's just a, you know, a sick piece of work. But, you know, I don't want to, you know, not promote, you know, I mean, like Hugh Hefner, who is not overtly Jewish, he would be someone that if I could, I would protect if I could go back in time. Believe me, it isn't just a Jewish versus Gentile, though it is unfortunately so often the case that it is. But there are plenty of Gentiles that need a good lashing, and I'd be happy to be the one to try, you know, to straighten all this out. You know, it's the racial thing, because there are, you know, such a large fraction of Jews in pornography and in the media, it becomes almost like they have this racial dialectic, and then it makes people think, you know, like, oh my gosh, you know, is this racism?
Yeah.
You just can't let the conversation get into it. I'm sure that the vast majority of Jewish people would be just perfectly willing to stand by us in the vigilante action, you know. But the thing is we just have to really be very clear about who we are trying to change their behavior, you know. I mean, in other words, we want to make sure to the extent we can, that we're really trying to defend ourselves against perpetrators.
Well, what exactly is, I mean, you talk about the base of the culture, and we start talking about celebrity and celebrity culture and why it was created in the first place. Of course, Hollywood creates this image of the celebrity for some sort ultimately we're getting into some sort of alchemy that's going on here. And I look at Hollywood sort of as a term, if you want to really explain how what's going on there, I call it Judeo-Masonic,
which is probably that's a good description, because that's I mean, it's that old, you know, it's a combination that I often point out. I mean, if you look at like Bimbo's Initiation, mm-hmm. which is online, and it's one of the very first cartoons, and Mickey Mouse is in it, it's put out by Max Fleischman and Walt Disney. Well, Disney was not on the credits, though his character Mickey Mouse is central, but it's all about a Freemason's initiation. Bimbo is going mm-hmm. to be taken into the lodge and joined. And Fleischman, you know, was a Mason. Now, what's amazing is that if you look at going back to the Hungarian Revolution, I mean, it was completely Masonic. It was just the like Bela Kohn, not calling him Kuhn, but Kohn. He was basically the head of a lodge, right? And all of the people around him, the kind of the military apparatus, were all basically Masons, but most of them were also Jews. There was actually, after the Hungarian Revolution, there was a lot of documentation that was done, and they were astounded when they went through it to find that, you know, like 85% of the people in authority during the event had been Jews. I mean, it almost gave the impression as though it was, wasn't really fought for political or, you know, some kind of economic philosophy, but was just rather kind of a racial destruction. This was actually how they came to look at it in Hungary post the event. And they actually then went after all the lodges and shut them down for a while. You know, now when you get to Hollywood, you have the same thing, and your description of it as like a Judaic Masonic combination. That's how I see it, Tim. I mean, that's what I see. When you look at Walt Disney, you're obviously looking at someone coming from the Masonic tradition. He supposedly is a Christian, but he certainly is, a de Molay and a Mason. And he works in conjunction with these other aspects who are Jewish to create the debased culture. But, you know, Tim, I wonder about Disney. And this is where you get DNA. It becomes a significant thing, because it makes, you know, like how did the Masons like Disney and Jewish pornographers like Max Fleischman? Because if you look at Bimbo's Initiation, which is online, people should look at it. At the end of it, to get Bimbo to join the lodge, they use pornography.
Mm-hmm.
They bring out Betty Boop, and she does an amazingly sexualized dance. I mean, it's a cartoon character, but watch the dance, and you'll see this is what makes Bimbo decide he's going to join the lodge. So here, in like 1929, you have this combination of Masonic Jewish influence creating a pornographic piece that is going to damage all the kids that look at this cartoon. And then they go forward and just see this combination just appears time and time again. And so, how do you explain Walt Disney? What would make someone like that, you know, participate in this? He's sort of like the Hays Code. You know, he is the way that show business becomes ubiquitous, mm-hmm. right? You have the Magic Kingdom. It's so benign. It's so gentle, but it becomes something that gets everywhere. And when you look at how the Disney park is set up, all of the writers that are being, you know, presented and the heroes, Davy Crockett, Mark Twain, and Lewis Carroll, they're all Masons,
yeah.
right? They're all, the park is nothing but a, you know, I use my expression, a Masonic cesspool.
There's even a Club 33 there, I think.
There's a Club 33 right on Main Street. And so now this then becomes something, but it's so loving, you know, Uncle Walt, he's with the Mouseketeers. He just seems so avuncular, you know, and everything is just fine. But Disney then goes out and it becomes part of the pornographic process. And now, I mean, Disney is just one of the premier pornographers in the world.
Yeah, because it's a huge media conglomerate. And
yeah, I mean, it's just part of the whole system. But the name Disney, the word Disney, was like the Hays Code. It was like, you know, the Legion of Decency. I mean, in other words, I just see Disney as I do not get him, Tim. He's definitely part of the deal. In other words, he's participating in a absolute genocidal debasement of supposedly the ethnicity and religion that he comes from. He's working in conjunction with these Jewish elements. Well, what how did he get there? You know, I don't think it was money. What is inside of de Molay and the Masons to get him to basically abandon just these natural, you know, alliances, that allegiances that you'd think he would have. And that's why I always wonder about his background, his DNA,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you can easily think of the idea of, you know, crypto Jew, right?
Yeah.
Now, I have no evidence of it, but the logic suggests it. And so that's why I've always thought, gee, I'd sure like to know Disney's background, his ethnic background, because, He has a kind of, you know, I hate to say it, but when you look at him, hey, he looks a little Jewish to me, you know. I mean, kind of, you know, in maybe a negative way. Okay, I'm sorry about that. But so that's just a question I have. And I you know, when you bring up the idea of this combination, that question is right there in front of us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We need to answer it.
Yeah. And if you look at the history of Disney, I think it was in December 1941, his studios were commandeered by the War Department, and it was used for, you know, propaganda throughout the war. I think they did work at Lookout Mountain and Laurel Canyon. They did a lot of animation for Why We Fight movies that were directed by Frank Capra, propaganda war films. Of course, the famous, you know, like Donald Duck propaganda things about paying your taxes and stuff during the war, withholding tax and the stuff. So, and the Disney Corporation, Hollywood in general, has always been an agent of the military industrial complex, the intelligence, and now it's that relationship has really developed. There's a liaison office now, and that's the exoteric relationship that the intelligence agencies have and the military has with Hollywood. Hollywood's there to promote, to create the propaganda, to promote the Anglo-American Zio Empire, the Judeo-Masonic world that we live in. Of course, when we're talking about something like CIA and Hollywood, when we're talking about CIA, we're not talking about CIA proper, as in Langley. We're talking about the corporate interests, the secret society connections, the banking
right.
interests that went into creating the agency. The agency is an agency that acts on behalf of these interests, these elite interests, and they are very much concerned with what the Pentagon calls full spectrum dominance, and they cannot have an institution like Hollywood, which is involved in creating our entertainment fair, which really determines how most people see the world. It would be nice if people read books, and thought about other things, but really most people's view of history in the world is through entertainment. And so it's very important. So the oligarchs are going to make sure that something like Hollywood, they're going to make sure that it exists. You know, maybe at some point it was spontaneous, but it was taken over a long time ago because the power of film was recognized, because this is the power of theater. And going back to the days of Plato, it was the theater that was used to entertain and beguile the masses on behalf of the oligarchs. You know.
Well, you know, you've seen my take on The Tempest.
Yes.
Which I think, you know, which is where the expression Brave New World comes from. I think I haven't brought out the analysis I've done. It's in my new book, The Secret Language of the Oligarchs, of Huxley's book, Brave New World. But, I mean, basically, the enchantment that is described in Brave New World, or excuse me, in The Tempest, is what is used as the way to maneuver all of the population into the controlled society where you have stratification of intellect, mm-hmm. and you have no families, the government, the state, which is basically the political power of a small group, creates all humans, controls them. And this is what is going on right now. I mean, this literally is what we are seeing. I you know, I've said this many times. I think the idea that, you know, parents would let basically the government mandate vaccinations is, I mean, you've just ceded your right to have humanity and be a part of it and to have, you know, your children participate in it. Because, you know, I'm not saying every vaccination is, you know, on the way to the Brave New World intellectual stratification, but in general, it is. In general, that's where we're going. In general, that's why, you know, they're probing and slowly getting us used to the toxicity, slowly getting us used to higher and higher percentages of the children being autistic. And you're going to end up with Miley Cyrus on one side and the vaccination needle on the other. You're going to have a pretty easy to control population. Mm-hmm. And so if you're, you know, people that are responding, you know, to our conversation or thinking that, you know, our position is coherent, well, you really have to take, you know, strong steps to protect your children.
Oh, but that's, because, I mean, the importance of Hollywood here is, of course, Hollywood's promotion of the, of modern medicine, of the, you know, whether it's through television shows, dramas like well, the ER, even going way back to, you know, Marcus Welby or Dr. Kildare, but also the normalization of autism, where, of course, just recently had a movie with Ben Affleck, CIA, playing this figure as an autistic person who's a virtual superhero because of his autism.
Sure.
There's a TV show, I think, called, is it called The Good Doctor, where the doctor is a, he's a young, is he young, is he a child? I think I could,
with, I haven't seen it.
With autism or something, he, and because of that, he's become, he's sort of this, he's this genius doctor because of his autism. He's a, yeah. He's a superhero. So these things are coming. This is the importance that entertainment does in shaping these things. There's also a lot of predictive programming. Of course, you know, I think it was in the late 90s. I think it was in the fall of 1997 that the movie Wag the Dog came out, that involved a president embroiled in a sex scandal, involved her with a young, like a Girl Scout or Girl Scout type organization. And this guy named, this character played by Marlon, what's his name? Robert De Niro, is a fixer. And they fake a war, you know, to cover up the sex scandal. And, of course, in that movie, there is a photograph of the president being hugged by the girl that he is caught having relations with, and she's wearing a beret.
Oh, my gosh.
And this is in the fall of 1997. The Monica Lewinsky scandal breaks in January 1998.
Yeah, and breaks, you know, Matt Drudge, who has some kind of mysterious background. And, you know, it's just he's the anti-mainstream media character. But, you know, he's just obviously a plant. You know, he's someone who's to create a new media, a new brand, so that you know, the attributes of the old media are like washed away, and suddenly you don't have anyone who's, you know, deliberately trying to mess with your mind. But he's bringing us the Clinton debacle,
which and, of course, what and that served alchemical. I think it covered up bigger scandals. Of course, Clinton obviously was, he gets caught and He distracts away from a scandal with a war.
But look at the details that come out. I mean, yes. It's sort of like
Today with Hollywood, right?
Yeah. Well, exactly right. I mean, it's like the Patty Hearst event.
It's pointless. Right. It's pointless.
Well, it's just that the details that are debasing could easily be kept private.
Yes.
I mean, believe me, in the 20s and 30s and 40s, you didn't get to learn about the stains on the dress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this doesn't happen. But, you know, now with the president of the United States, you get basically, the most lurid sex details imaginable. What is the point of it? If you look at all of this as basically a theater, right, that this is just deliberate theater that they're producing for us. We're looking at a show, kind of a reality TV show, that's for basically our moral, destruction. What's the point of it? Well, isn't it obvious? I mean, it's just basically to normalize pornography.
Well, it's like comedian Louis C.K.
Yeah.
And this woman, they accuse him of exposing himself and suggesting certain things that he masturbated in front of them. Now, this is a private matter, from what I understand, in a room, okay, that he's done this. It's a he said, she said case. He cops to it, admits to it, okay, apologizes, blah, blah, blah. Now, all this detail, now, from what I understand, there's no necessary crime here. It's just another degenerate celebrity, making a pass, a rather peculiar, odd pass at a woman. And they apparently all walk out or whatever. The point is, the detail is shared with everybody.
I'll bet you a dime to a dollar. What you're looking at is just a scripted.
Yes, yeah.
All scripted. Al Franken suddenly leaps into the fray. They even had, someone accused George W. Senior Bush.
Yeah, that was, yeah.
Yeah, this is the Harvey Weinstein meme is just a way to basically push the idea that, sex is something that is separate from family, separate from marriage. It's going on all the time. You're bringing in the feminist dialectic. They're saying, this is all, shows we need more basically separation between the sexes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Look, Tim, what we need is more unification of the sexes. We need more family. That's what we need. All of this multicultural stuff, the fragmentation, this all leads to the Brave New World. And that's why I've been suggesting that, get rid of expressions like multiculturalism and feminism and replace them with the right phrase, which is easy to enslave.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because if you want to bring out the idea that fragmented, you're weaker. So always use the correct expression. It is the feminine version of being easy to enslave, or the different culture version of easy to enslave, but it's all making us easier to enslave. Keep that expression and keep that thought, and then you won't be flipped into crazy dialectics that are artificial, which are just there to keep you from seeing what's real, which is you're getting to be easy to enslave. That's why this whole... I mean, given that they control the media, look at something like Clinton, the Lewinsky thing. And obviously Lewinsky, I think, has been pretty well vetted as an operative at this point. I certainly see her as such. Anyway, when you look at this and you go, well, if they can control the media, well, how could this have come? Why would the story be laid out? Well, it's fragmenting all of the family. It's creating an awareness that even the president of the United States, is engaging in these activities. Family, the thread that holds family together is just being stripped away, one thread at a time. And what does this all mean? It just means they're making us easier to enslave. Mm-hmm. It's not hard to see, Tim, what this all is leading to.
And if we are indeed living in a liberated world where we're all sexually free, what's the significance of these accusations? Because it's really nothing much. It's just sex, as we heard back in the late 90s. It's just sex. What's the big deal?
Well, they just want to to flame up the dialectic at the same time, because it's a twofer. They get to both debase the sexual standards and also fragment men and women.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they get both sides of their what they're aiming for.
Because the Weinstein narrative is just it's men, it's male behavior, and that's as if it's nothing to do with particularly Hollywood or power or just the industry itself. It's male behavior, and we're going to get more of these speech codes and universities,
and more female executives in show business, which will just create more feminist video content. Which should be called what it is, just more easy to enslave.
Yeah, a guy sent me this thing, but the CDC has a program about it's developed to introduce in high schools and colleges about how to avoid sexual assault, harassment on dates. And it's one thing is how to make sure you have consent. Well, problem is if you have a high school program that's teaching how to get consent, you have this high school that's promoting illicit sex. What they're saying is they're promoting promiscuity. And then they said, my question is, since when is sexual assault a disease? This is the CDC doing this, right? I mean, it's like, why do they, so someone got paid a lot of money to produce this, it's one of these stupid harassment, seminar programs that they make people go through, and they're going to implement these in colleges and stuff like that. And the same time they create, we've talked about this before, the same time they create them, so this mass situations in colleges where all inhibitions are broken down, they throw these young people together at parties with a lot of drugs or a lot of alcohol, the whole party environment, then they're in a permissive environment, then they're shocked, and they're shocked that there's problems on campus, And then the whole point, the whole point of the situation isn't supposed to make any sense, and there's no coherence to this, is you're supposed to get mixed messages, because it's the confusion that they want. And then you get this sort of this pathologizing male behavior, so men can't even court anymore because it's too risky, and they make sure that men don't know how to court anymore because they've
spread
pornography all around. Yeah.
It's the apex of sanity.
Yeah.
It's the apex of, civilization. If you don't have courtship, in other words, profound romantic connection between young adults, male and female, heterosexual adults, you've got no civilization. And the individuals are never really themselves. I mean, the people who cannot participate in courtship, don't have the capacity, are like shadow beings. They're like half alive. They are literally realizing about, just a tiny fraction of what they could experience in terms of just sort of the existential universe, right? Mm-hmm. They are just like shadows. They can go to, the males can go to bars and hook up sex. I mean, women can, find some kind of, sisterhood and solidarity in feminism. But look, billions of years of evolution has wired us so that we are supposed to exist in heterosexual family societies. And if you cannot court, if you cannot, find it in yourself to have that unique romantic feeling about someone and then use that as the basis for how you approach the individual, how you try to structure the future with the individual, you just are, and this is what I get a chance to talk from time to time to young people. And I always say that to these guys, I go, look, you really have to find a way to protect your heart. I was talking to a group the other day that had been to prison, and they were talking about, in prison, you have to make adjustments in order to survive,
mm-hmm.
You've got to become hard, it's violent. And so the question, or at least the discussion, it got around, well, how can you protect your heart in such an environment? How can you use what you have to, come up with in order to get through the process, but then at the end of it, still have the capacity to live a life that is you know, as high a value as you can get. In other words, how can you actually love after you've been inside prison? And, you know, my advice was, I'm not sure it's very smart, but I said, you know, you should try to read poetry that is about, and books and things that is about love, mm-hmm. that is about romantic love, because this will basically keep that part of your soul in existence, even though you have to, you know, basically give the position of fighting down to the last ounce of your breath in order to avoid being raped mm-hmm. As you go out into the yard as a prisoner, you know. So you have to try to work to keep your heart in existence during the process. And I realized, you know, I was driving home and I said, you know, that's really like what our whole world is. You know, the problem that these guys were having and the issues they have, it's the same thing that we all have, because we have to be so deformed and we are given so many cues that we need to find ways to protect our heart, you know. And that's just something people need to be aware of, because, you know, we are already in kind of an intellectual and emotional prison, and we have already made adjustments. When you think of like kind of how vicious feminists have become, right? Mm-hmm. When you think of like a lot of the ways that the hookup males talk about females, right? I mean, their participation and enjoyment of this kind of pornography, right? Mm-hmm. They're being subjected to basically prison kinds of conditions, and they don't have it in their mind that they really need to find a way to protect their heart. They need to find a way to not only be able to resist, but also to still have enough humanity left after the fight to be able to live a real life, to not just be a shadow person, you know, who has an intellectual understanding of world and culture, but, you know, but no ability to participate in courtship, in romance, in family, you know, in parenthood, in the ways that will let you have a real life, mm-hmm. a life that we have been created for by evolution, a life that is the, you know, the real manifestation of your biology.
Hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, basically, it's getting back to nature, understanding what's normal, what's nature, what's natural to the two respective sexes, and of course, that means acknowledging differences and the complementary differences. And for the past 50, 60 years, to do that would be is considered regressive, and a lot of people, they're not happy. I heard a statistic that 1 in 4 young women under the age of 30 are on some sort of psychiatric or psychotropic drug, dealing with anxiety and their unhappiness. And so you have this chemically induced insanity that men have to deal with. You know, you have the suicide. I think there are 38,000 suicides in the United States a year. 30,000 of them are men. You know, so something is awfully wrong here. We shouldn't be doing this to each other. But I think both the promotion of pornography, the Playboy culture, and the promotion of feminism was there to create this dialectic,
exactly
antagonistic relationship, pulling at different ends. And I think, you know, if you do your homework, you find the secret society, intelligence agencies, their foundations, their media conglomerates, all working together to promote this.
Of course, these structures would never occur naturally or accidentally. It's almost impossible. I mean, if you just this is kind of a long sort of, you know, bit of analysis, but you know, I mean, I was just sort of the fact. There's just no way these kinds of things would ever occur naturally. It's just impossible. There'd be no attraction to them. I mean, feminism would not exist if there weren't the Judaic Masonic, you know, kind of grinding to take society into this brave new world situation.
Yeah, I mean, why do we know who Gloria Steinem is? What in this, you know?
Yeah. Well, but see, that's just
woman from Akron, Ohio, from a Jewish family, right. In Akron. Why do we know?
I'm, I mean, if feminism would occur naturally, why would the CIA need to create an operative as as destructive as Gloria Steinem?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they wouldn't need to do it. See, it's not a natural phenomena. The feminism before Steinem was really an economic issue. It would have never gone anywhere. It just would have fizzled out. But it became a media event. It was promoted basically by the same power that was promoting pornography.
Yeah.
And for the same reason. So this is like, you know, as I said, we have the same problems as the prisoners did, is how to protect our heart, you know, because we have to learn to fight. Right now we're just we're impotent in all ways. You know, we don't know how to fight. We don't even understand that we really have to fight, let alone know how to fight. And we also don't get that we have to protect our heart. You know, I mean, things that are valuable, we just don't even recognize. It's been taken away. I mean, all of the sort of the courtship elements are, you know, very rarely promoted inside showbiz, even though that should just be, you know, the most important thing. It would be what people would gravitate to normally if we had a free media.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's just as more, you know, so we were talking like a couple of weeks ago about how we're kind of, you know, building out a schematic of how have been attacked and how we're being attacked today. And we're in our discussions, we kind of just build it out one piece at a time. And I hope people that listen to our shows are, you know, kind of get a more complete picture, and hope you and I do as we go through the process, you know. And it ends up with an understanding, but we have to transition from there to action. And action is, you know, fight, resist, and also protect your heart. Don't let yourself become someone who is not able to be part of a family.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, well, Joe.
We just want to say before we wrap up, Jim, yep, our next show will be our holiday special.
Yeah.
Where we're going to be revisiting the idea of the normie.
Yeah, the trouble with normies.
The trouble with normies, because over the holidays we have a feeling that a lot of people will be having this issue of family members that don't understand 911 and how do you deal with them. And so it should be a great addition to the Thanksgiving turkey, don't you think, Tim?
Yes.
Our discussion about how to deal with normies.
Yeah. So. So, okay, listen, I'll let you go, Joe.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you next week.
Next week. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Have a great Thanksgiving.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.